Welcome to my interview with Professor Sean Kimber from my project, Profiles on Influence. Professor Kimber is mixed race and comes from a southern family. Her mother is from Charleston, South Carolina, and identifies as Gucci Gullah, and her father grew up in northern Alabama and had ancestors who picked cotton. She grew up in Tallahassee, Florida, and has experienced discrimination based on her gender in addition to racial issues. She talked about how she learned to deal with discrimination at an early age, and that probably helped her as she chose to enter the math and science fields where there are few minorities and few women. She talked about how she fought with Lafayette College administration to start a summer program to advance leadership in the summer of 2009. The program brought students from Puerto Rico, Houston, Brooklyn, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey interested in science or engineering to school early during the summer to introduce them to the topics and career options in the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics fields. The program gives priority to students who had high SAT scores and are from groups that are underrepresented in the science and engineering fields at Lafayette. Kimber received Lafayette's Marquis Distinguished Teaching Award for her efforts both in and out of the classroom last May. Kimber has worked to provide opportunities for minorities in the math and science fields her entire career. 2 summers ago, she received a Serve America grant from the Corporation for National Community Service, along with a colleague at Middlebury College. Together, they created a course development workshop on the mathematics of social justice. She also worked successfully to get another grant that funded Lafayette's community-based learning and research initiative. These programs teach professors to educate students about how they can use their skills in the classroom to better the community and why not having these skills can result in social injustice. Professor Kimber has been a role model and a mentor for people that she believes are underrepresented in her profession. Her influence has undoubtedly enabled many students to recognize their ability to succeed in the math and science majors. Her work is important in solving the problems that I am focusing on, and her story explains her motivations. I now present my interview with Professor Sean Kimber.
Yes. Okay. Awesome. All right, so I'm actually going to record an intro, and so we don't need to do any intro. We're just going to kind of jump right in.
Cool.
All right, so can you just tell me a little bit about your background growing up and about you?
Okay, so I come from a very southern family. So my mother's from Charleston, South Carolina, and actually the Barrier Islands off the coast. She's what's known as Gucci Gullah. And my father's from northern Alabama, very rural. Family would pick cotton way mm-hmm. back when. And, you know, this combination of families has been always very interesting combination. But, you know, I have a very mixed race background, Cherokee, Chickasaw, white, mm-hmm. black, of unidentified origin, and all of the above. I grew up in Tallahassee, very southern city, very much part of that southern, old southern culture. You know, you go to cotillions and you wear your big hoop skirts kind of society. And so women were expected to conform to a certain goal in life of an MRS degree. And you did go to college, but it wasn't about getting educated particularly towards doing anything other than being married and being a mother.
Do you think growing up in the South caused you more issues for your gender or for your race?
I think it was more about gender than race. I think I actually appreciate that I was brought up in the South where I was confronted in a very direct way about race on a regular basis. So that from the time I was very young, I had to deal with the fact that people hated me for reasons that I could not change. And so I'm not suddenly confronted with this in the middle of my life. Instead, I have a long series of experiences to reflect on when I'm confronted with a new experience. Mm-hmm. So it's not that I accept things more, but I'm better able to categorize what needs to be acted upon and what doesn't.
Where did you turn when you had your family, when you had racial problems or gender problems or anything?
Probably to my father. Then also, too, I have an older sister and brother who are 5 years older than me, and so, you know, if I was experiencing something in first grade as sixth graders, they would be able to better guide me with how to talk to other mm-hmm. kids in yeah. those situations.
besides your family, who else, I mean, were your role models growing up? I mean, like, celebrities, political figures, any, who did you look up to?
I think I looked up mainly to my teachers, mm-hmm. who would have been the celebrities of my life then. But then I also was a very active flutist, and so my heroes were flutists in major orchestras. I mean, I was very much a nerd, mm-hmm. so I had different kinds of heroes. I mean, I grew up in the 80s, so who was presented to girls in the 80s as the icon to live up to? Molly Ringwald.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a better icon than the Cindy Crawford that we were presented with in all the media, right? At that time, there weren't a lot of black women presented in a major way. That's when Oprah was first getting started, and that Whitney Houston,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, the whole drug thing, you know?
Yeah.
So there weren't a lot of people who looked like me for me to look up to. In that sense, and so it was more through the skill sets that I wanted that I created my own heroes, and they were actually more accessible to me.
Do you think the lack of people that looked like you as celebrities affected what you wanted to do with your life?
I don't know. I think I certainly always wanted to be a teacher. I didn't know I wanted to be a college professor because I didn't have any role models, any people who were college professors who looked like me. And I didn't until, I had a female math professor in my senior year of college, and that's when I said, oh, wait, women do this? And, you know, and it's strange to be that sort of dense, but when you're constantly surrounded by male professors, I was often the only female in my classes, certainly the only minority in all of my classes. I started to think that maybe this wasn't where I was supposed to be, even though I was performing well in the classes.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't until there was a woman in front of the class and I could say, yes, okay, it's okay for me to consider this career path.
Yeah.
But as far as celebrities go, I've just never been, obviously I've failed to live up to the model, the supermodel icons, right? So Naomi Campbell was the famous black woman, an Iman, I'm not tall, and I'm never going to be that skinny, I looked up to them as role models as far as an image goes, but never as who I was going to be or how I was going to behave.
Mm-hmm. I had a question lined up, I'm sorry. How do you think the media today influences people's visions of race?
Well, there are a lot of ways.
I mean,
right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are a lot of different types of media, right?
Mm-hmm.
So certainly the MTV culture, the BET culture is very much the hip-hop gangster Jezebel images of men and women. There are very few positive role models in that environment, unless your goal in life is to be a thug, I guess. But, you know, obviously there are very good musicians, but the image that's projected is not based on their talents, it's based on this other thing that they want to be viewed as, which is kind of strange dichotomy. But what it does is that those whose only interaction with people of color is through television, they're not presented with very many options of categories they can put somebody into. So you run into me on Lafayette College's campus, no one immediately assumes that I'm a professor, right?
Mm-hmm.
The immediate assumption is maybe a secretary, maybe a custodian, but that's even rare here on Lafayette's campus to have a custodian of color. And we run out.
I walk into the bookstore and people, during football season, people say, tough game yesterday. It's like, I don't play football. I don't play football.
How do you react to that?
I mean, I could sit there and tell them, I could be like, you can't assume that I play football just because, but I mean, I'm a big guy and, I'm not a tall guy, but I mean, I look like I could play football. And so, I mean, like, I can't assume that it's based on my race, but at the same time, I know that some of it is, and it's tough. It's Lafayette's fault as much as it is their fault, because
mm-hmm.
how many black people here are not in posse and not on football? or basketball. Very, very few.
And but we're also not teaching students and, you know, of course our alumni base, who are the ones visiting for football games, mm-hmm. that they need to have an open mind about possibilities of who mm-hmm. we are.
So I just say, it was a tough game. I was there, you know. Yeah. As far as your profession now as a college professor, what are you doing stuff related to race?
Yes, I am.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So I am a professor in the sciences, and this is a area that has very few students of color actually choosing a major, but even beyond that, very few students of color or even women take courses past a certain level. Mm-hmm. So for me, the diversity of my classroom is very meaningful because I think of it in terms of what is my contribution to fixing a national problem, not just a problem at Lafayette. So one thing that I do is I work with Sharon Jones over in engineering, and we built a program for incoming students who satisfy certain diversity categories. So females wanting to major in science and engineering, minorities, first generation students, you know, a whole host of factors that make students unusual at Lafayette. We bring them into campus for 6 weeks in the summer to take a couple of classes and really get acclimated to being on this campus and making them into leaders in some sense. Because they might have come in and started a step behind, but we've gotten them a step ahead by the end of those 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's, you know, some small contribution I can make to, you know, over time, eventually we're going to have more diverse classrooms in the sciences and engineering, hopefully. And this is just one dimension of an effort that the college ought to be making towards doing this.
And how long have you been doing this?
This is our second year.
Okay.
Yeah. It actually took 8 years of lobbying the administration to get some movement on this. So that was a previous president. The new president, Dan Weiss, was very much interested in the idea. It was just a matter of finding the money for him. So I think that's a great movement forward for Lafayette, but that's just one tiny thing. Mm-hmm.
I think that ties in a lot with the fact that, a lot of kids growing up who are, you know, either minority youth or non-minority youth just they don't understand that it is possible for a person of color to be a college professor, to take part in the sciences and maths and, you know, just do things that you don't see them doing on TV.
Exactly.
And can you talk a little bit about how you think, besides what you're already doing, how you think we can, as a society more than as a college or as individuals, but as a whole, kind of improve kind of inform the people, you know, mm-hmm. that it is possible.
So there are a lot of small agencies, but even like Black Enterprise Magazine will run its top 100 Black entrepreneurs every once in a while. But it's just one issue. One issue that just goes by.
Mm-hmm. And which magazine is this?
Black Enterprise, but there are also lots of other organizations that are sort of small scale that do things like this. Mm-hmm. So I was recently just looking at a list of the top African American physicists. It's a very short list, mm-hmm. But a very interesting, tangible list that you can just search on the web, but it's not publicized to the, you know, Black physicists exist.
Mm-hmm.
The most famous would be Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's the head of the Hayden Planetarium in New York, who actually was a speaker here at Lafayette in February. And it's efforts like that of connecting to these things. But it's such small-scale, hidden, short-term. It's like February is Black History Month, and we don't need to talk about it other than those 28 days. And, of course, it's the shortest month of the year. And what we really need to do is kind of broaden that out and have it be Black Enterprise should talk about a really nice entrepreneur every month and not just 101 month and we toss that issue away.
And I would argue that it should be in Time Magazine.
Absolutely.
And not Black Enterprise. Like, but I was flipping through the McDonough report the other day,
mm-hmm.
and I was thinking, you know, why can't they just have a magazine? Why can't it go in the Lafayette and they have articles like this in the Lafayette instead of the McDonough Report? Okay, you know, like, let's talk about what's going on with the black people on campus right now.
Yeah, well, we do have, you know, all these glossy magazines, but it's so rare that they would feature someone.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's a wrong-headed way of approaching these issues. But the response to that was to produce this magazine that's specifically about African American alums, and then the hope is that over time it would end up filtering in because you prove there's actual material to have. But we have this very big segregation problem here on the campus. You might notice that we have the diversity awards, and then a week later we have the honors convocation, and there's this very distinct separation.
Mm-hmm.
There are very few students of color who are being honored at the honors convocation, which is evidence of a problem on the campus.
Yes.
And it's obviously a recruitment problem, but it also extends further into, you know, the students that are getting research projects, students who are being supported by the faculty on the campus. A lot of our students of color are not necessarily ignored. That might be too strong of a word, but they're invisible. They fall through the cracks, and a lot of people aren't paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this separate ceremony that your majority faculty can choose not to go to. And so then it's still separate, invisible.
Separate and not equal.
Yeah. Right.
Seen that before. How do you think, what, this is a tough question. I mean, I think that I've heard a lot of people say, you know, there's a black president, you know, racism's over, you know. How do you think, do you think that the racial issues in this country are getting better? And if they are, do you think it's at an acceptable rate?
So having the perspective of my many years of life, right?
Better than mine.
But there's absolutely no doubt that things are better now than they were when my parents were in college,
mm-hmm.
right? So
mm-hmm.
my parents had no choice about what college they would go to. They went to the black college in the state where they grew up, and that was it. In fact, my mother, the state of South Carolina, gave her a scholarship to leave the state of South Carolina so that she wouldn't ask to integrate their schools.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that sort of blatant racism is no longer institutionalized, right? So
mm-hmm.
now that would be considered illegal, and we can start to talk about that. So that's a major step forward. Compared to my childhood, I don't think that we've gone very far, you know. So, should I say how old I am? Okay, well, 39-ish
mm-hmm.
years is, to my mind, a long time. But it's not very long in terms of the evolution of a culture, right? And so I grew up under very strong affirmative action laws that allowed me to gain scholarships and admission to certain institutions that helped me move along, also helped other women move along. And there was a lot of backlash during the 80s about this, and there were several court cases. And the Supreme Court found either way, generally speaking, it was slowly kind of whittling away at the affirmative action programs on both sides, like
mm-hmm.
improving a little and then getting rid of another thing, improving a little, getting rid of. And we're now in the place where you have such a conservative Supreme Court that chances are it's just going to eventually be eliminated. And I don't think that that's right, because we aren't at a place where we have a level playing field yet. So is it moving at a good pace? I don't know that we can move the culture much faster.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not until that we can actually accept each other that we're going to be changing beyond where we are now. So there's some... the rhetoric about Obama is so race-based that to say that, you know, we're in a post-racial society is absolutely ridiculous.
What I would say is, you know, when there were, you know, a quarter of the country who was voting on him and had, you know, more than a quarter had race as a, you know, top three factor in their vote, whether it was for yes or for no.
Yeah.
I just can't accept that, you know, it's over because it was post-racial society.
Exactly.
I tell people that, and I mean, like, their response is, you know, you're you have a president now.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no, you have a president too. We have a president.
He's our president.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter that he's black. It's, you know, it's, we have a president.
What I like is that we have a smart president.
Exactly.
gosh, what was I going to say? Oh, yes. National Public Radio did interviews in small towns around the United States during the campaign, for presidential campaign. And they did a few in York, Pennsylvania, which isn't very far from here. And those were the most disturbing of all. The gist of them were, we won't be able to keep the black people are going to have such big egos, they're going to think that it's their turn, and we're going to feel the wrath, and they're going to turn it back around on us. And I was so shocked to hear that, because that sounds like something out of the 1950s. What do they expect, that we're going to sharpen up our plowshares? I don't understand.
That sounds to me like that's something not only that I would hear back in Maine, mm-hmm. you know, and wouldn't be surprised. But it also sounds like those are people who are, you know, fitting exactly into what I'm talking about, is people who get their image of what an African-American person is from the media. You know, mm-hmm. they think that, you know, every black person has the characteristics of Lil Wayne or Kanye West, or, you know,
yeah.
and has an ego and is going to, you know, say, okay, now we got this, like, I want more. And I don't know that I even think that those people are like that. I think that that's what their image is, but mm-hmm. I think that that's what the media is kind of making them to be.
Right.
And I just think, I don't know.
Have you ever had someone tell you you're not really black?
I've had people, that was something I was going to say. I remember back home, I mean, like, in Maine, you know, people, they watch MTV, they watch BET, and they hang out with me, and they're like, you're not black enough.
Yeah.
It's like, for who? Yeah. I'm not black enough for who? You know, like, for you? Do you want a different kind of black friend? Because in another interview I did is, I don't remember who it was, but they said that there is no definition. Being black is undefined, because mm-hmm. if you are black, then you are black. You know, it doesn't matter what you've been through. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter, you know, what you do, or, you know, it's who you are. As long as you identify as black, that's mm-hmm. what you are. I think that there are white people who identify as black.
Oh, yeah.
And I absolutely don't really have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's how they identify.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I could tell them they're not black enough for me, but I wouldn't do that, because right. it's not important to me.
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, like, I guess the main issue of this entire study is that people are making a way too big deal out of race,
mm-hmm.
and that race is defining for people things, characteristics about, you know, other people that they're just, in, you know, kind of throwing at them.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I think that's ridiculous. Do you have anything else to add? I don't know. I think, feel like a...
You have enough?
I feel like I might, unless...
Yeah.
Unless you have anything else.
No, I mean, so the not black enough thing
is
interesting, because I get invited to give mathematical presentations about my research at certain institutions, and the organizers typically ask me to also speak to a group of their minority students, and invariably they ask me to talk about my urban upbringing, and how I overcame poverty.
And struggle.
Yeah, and I'm like, okay, I struggled in the suburbs of Tallahassee in an upper middle class family. And, you know, it's not the story that they want to hear. I certainly had my struggles. They just came in a different form. And some of them determined that I have nothing to offer their students, which to me is kind of odd. To kind of rule out certain possible role models just because they don't fit their definition of a black mathematician.
It's an entire portion of, I mean, like, I think that that's the section of society that I want, that I think needs to be shown, is that, you know, young kids, white and black, need to see that there is a significant portion of the country that is upper middle class, that are upper middle class minorities, and mm-hmm. they're doing well, and they're doing things that, you know, you know little kids might want to do when they get older. You know, like myself, for example, I wanted to be a professional basketball player until I was about a sophomore in high school, because I thought that that's what black people did.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, I had really no one in Maine to be like, look at me, I'm doing this, and you know, so it was very difficult. And when I realized, you know, hey, I'm not 6 feet tall, I'm not, you know, I'm definitely not going to the NBA. It was like, okay, you know, I guess academics is what I have to focus on. Or, I mean, like, and I don't know what I want to focus on academically. I don't know where I want to go with that, but I'm going to have to find some people who I can look up to who are, you know, black intellectuals doing things that I might be interested in outside of sports, outside of movies, outside of music. And I think that there are, I mean, kids are, you know, whether they're growing up in Maine, whether they're growing up in, you know, this, you know, New York City, you know, and it's just, I mean, like, they need to see that there are people succeeding outside of what they see on TV, what they hear on the radio, on posters, on billboards, and stuff like that. And that's, I think, what I want to, that's what my focus is on the study.
Sounds great.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Let's see.